Just Not Good Enough with Chaz House on FUBAR Radio.
I'm here today with Sheila Lusada, who is,
hello,
a long-time friend of mine. We've known each other for 20 years or more. 2002, I think, was the first time we met.
21 years.
21 years. Yeah. And so welcome to Just Not Good Enough.
Thank you.
That's a pleasure.
Great title.
Yes, it is, isn't it? Yeah, I know. It sort of gets to the heart of it.
Absolutely.
About,
and we can talk about that later.
Well, we,
it does.
We can, yeah, because that whole thing. People say imposter syndrome, but I'm not sure what quite how that relates to being just not good enough. Mm. You know, that I think there's a subtle difference between those two.
Anyway,
welcome.
Thank you.
So we're going to have a chat about mental health in general.
Yeah.
So why don't you just do a little intro about who you are, why you're here, what you think, and then we'll say goodbye and wrap it up.
Well, I think I'm hoping you're going to ask me some really insightful questions to get me rolling. But briefly, let's start now. So I am, I've got a portfolio career, let's say now.
Yeah, you have.
So I am I retrained to be a coach about, well, just after I work with you actually at Southport.
Oh, God. that's nothing to do with me.
No, nothing to do with that.
It was with me, not for me, wasn't it? So that's helpful.
Yes, it was with you. I had a real, I think having kids made me really think what I was doing in life and what I was contributing. So previous to that, I'd worked in the corporate world, which I loved. I absolutely loved it, in research and strategy, met some great people, learnt loads, partied hard. Then had my kids quite late in life, and I think I had this real social conscience thing, partly from a little bit of work I did with the kids company when I worked at Unilever.
As in Kath Kitson?
No. The kids company was run by a lady called Camilla. I can't quite pronounce her surname.
Right.
It actually was under a lot of investigation.
Was that the charity? Was it
the charity?
Oh, God, yes. That was a disaster, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't, actually. It was, the work she did was amazing, but I don't think she was a great businesswoman, and so
no.
I think they spent more than they had.
Yes,
but the actual model of what she did, helping disadvantaged children, was just unbelievable. And it was when I was working there, a guy said to me, we were doing some fundraising stuff, and he just said, you're on fire. I've never seen you like this before. And I thought, wow. And it was that thing about I really wanted to help. I wanted to do some good. And it was linked very much to kids, having had my own kids and finding this side of me that was very nurturing, which I'd never really had before.
Wow.
So it was that big thing. I wanted to sort of scoop them all up, you know, like a mother hen and save all these children. So to cut a long story short, I then trained as a coach, specialised in working with kids, set up my own business to teach emotional resilience and well-being in schools.
Your own business? Have you still got
that? Yes, I still have that. Good Talk Coaching. Very good name.
You know,
A lot in that name.
Isn't it a good name?
Yeah,
I didn't know you'd called it that, actually.
Yeah. So I still do that, although budgets in schools aren't great at the moment, so I have less work, certainly in state schools, than I ever have. And then I do one-to-one coaching with young people on anything from stress to confidence to body image, the whole lot. And more recently, I did a course with a company called the Hoffman Institute, which you may have heard of.
Yes.
It's a very...
Through you, actually.
Yeah. Immersive, in-depth, one-week self-development course, which I went on, learnt loads, loved the company, applied for a job, and I've ended up working there, freelancing, doing various bits for them. So I'm very, very much working in the mental health arena. And that partly comes from, I think, a recognition that I suffer from depression and have done on and off for years, and I want to help other people that, you know, I think it's all about positive mental health, not you know, the deep depressing stuff. Is how can we encourage people to look after their mental health like we look after people's physical health? So what can we put in place for people to prevent some of the things that happen to perhaps more people in our generation because we didn't know about that. So I've gone all over the place
Honestly, well, that wraps it up then, doesn't it? Thank you very much. So goodbye.
Yeah.
God, there's a hell of a lot there. Yeah. So I want to go back a little bit because you didn't start there, did you? You started, you come from Manchester.
I do indeed.
You went out with Johnny Marr of the Smiths.
I did. I actually went to primary school.
I'm not envious of going out with him. Did you?
I went to primary school with him first off, and then I went off to a very strict Catholic convent school run by nuns.
Yeah,
very, very good school actually. In today's world would be more equivalent to a private school, but really good Catholic, very strict, but some great friends. I had some really good friends there, and then had a little fling, let's say, with Johnny Marr when I was about 14. And then he found somebody else.
Oh, bastard.
Who he actually went on to marry.
No.
Angela.
Oh, yeah, you missed it by one.
I did.
Just think where your life could have gone.
I don't think I was real rock star chick material, to be honest with you.
You are. No. But just think, you know, the Smiths, in my opinion, the best band in the world ever.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Closely followed by The Cure, I must admit, which is interesting. It's Manchester and London.
Yeah.
But you have a very definite preference for the North, don't you? And not in a derogatory way, but just your roots are up there. That's where you come from. Your family's up there.
Yeah. Yeah. So there is a saying, you can take the girl out of Manchester, but you can't take Manchester out of the girl. And I do think... Yeah, that my heart is up north and always will be. And it's partly because of the people. They are so warm, so friendly. I won't say nobody has egos, but it's more authentic. And that could also be, when I reflect on it, I think it could also be my background, which is very working class rather than middle class.
Yeah.
And I think there's something more honest about working class people as they were then. I don't think that the same necessarily applies now because I think it's all changed.
It's moved on,
So, if I'm honest, I sometimes think, God, how have I ended up in this middle class world in Surrey, which is very not me.
Yes, it's interesting because, I mean, I was born in North London, or just north of London, and went to school in Oakham in Leicestershire for 5 years and then went to Nottingham for 10 years.
Yeah.
And if I had a choice of where I'd live... now, I would go north.
Yeah,
I would probably end up in the northern bits of Nottinghamshire.
Yeah,
Which is where Sue, my wife, comes from actually. Yeah. Or event where I met her, and just because it's more honest.
We've
spoken many times, haven't we, about the type of pubs that we like.
Yeah,
and you know, the grittier the better.
Yeah,
the full of people who are just in there having a pint with their mates.
Yeah,
probably no food.
Yeah,
you know, real ale, proper bloody atmosphere, probably no music.
Well, I worked in one of those for about 3 years when I was at university. Every time I went home, it was called The Crown.
Is it still there?
It's still there. It was so traditional. It had two sides of the pub, the bar and the vault.
It still had a vault. It's like a snug in a lounge,
isn't it? The old men used to go. And I never saw any women in there.
I don't know whether they weren't allowed,
but they didn't go in there. And it was, all the old men nursing their pints. And then the bar was just full of sports.
What is it? It's the beer up there. It's Holt's, isn't it? Is it Holt's?
Boddington's.
No, there's a Holt's as well, because my brother-in-law lived in just north of Warrington.
Okay.
And he always used to swear by Holt's beer because it was cheaper.
Okay. Right.
And bloody hell, it was good. Yeah. And the number of times we've sat in pubs like that, having a pint and a conversation, there's nothing better in the world, frankly.
Yeah.
Anyway, right, I could talk about that all day, really. Let's do my favourite beers, shall we? what did you do at university?
I did food science at university and then went on to do a master's in marketing at a college that was part of Cranfield Institute.
Okay. So, well, that's pretty good.
It was good. I'll just tell you the reason I did it is because I didn't know what I wanted to do.
So I like studying.
I like the party side of university. Let's go and do another course. And that's what I did.
Yeah, it's tempting, isn't it? That.
Very tempting. It was actually a really good move, though, because nobody in those days, or very few people, did a master's. So I was, when I did go out into the world of work, that gave me a head start over other people.
So you did go out to work, didn't you? So
after.
Because now you're saying earlier you worked on... you're working for your own business in effect.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're doing lots of, I'll call it charity work, but it's not. It's well-meaning work, if you like, but you get paid for it.
Yes, more what I see as more socially useful.
That's the better expression, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But you did start off in the corporate world.
I did.
So yes, who did you work for?
Lots of different companies. So I started off with a company called the Leatherhead Food Research Association, which I think might still be around, actually. It was quite an academic place that just used to write reports on food. Quite bizarre. It still had a typing pool in the middle of the building. So you used to write things by hand and send them down.
Well, you said I've worked in businesses like that as well. Yeah.
So I didn't stay there very long. Then I moved to Spillers Pet Foods on their graduate scheme. And that's when I really started sort of proper work with in their market research department.
Right.
And then from there, stayed in that field and went to work for...
As market research,
right. Which now is known as Consumer Insight. But it was a bit of everything, really. A bit of strategy, a bit of planning, new product development.
Execution.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah. So really, it sort of suited me because it was very much about understanding people. Plus, there was a bit of academic stuff in terms of methodologies and stuff. So I was lucky. I sort of fell into it and it really, you know, was a good fit, I think, with me.
So did you stay with FMCG, Fast Moving Consumer Goods, or did you do other bits?
So I did both. So mostly my jobs were in FMCG. So I worked for Unilever, L'Oreal. I did a little spell in banking for TSB. But I also did a little bit of time. Actually, no, it was a good few years, actually, in a retail organisation at Homebase as when it was part of Sainsbury's.
Oh, yes, of course it was, isn't it? I forgot that.
Yeah. And then latterly for when I was doing a bit of freelance for Debenhams. So
you've had three sectors, essentially, haven't you? You've had FMCG, financial services and retail.
Yeah, yeah.
The cultures of those.
Yeah.
Three sectors are very different be very different.
Yeah.
So just describe a little bit about, if you can, about mm-hmm. what you saw, what you found, which ones you prefer.
Mm-hmm. It's like any roles and companies, they've all got their good bits and their bad bits. So FMCG in general is slower. My experience of the cultures there, certainly when I worked for Unilever, much more nurturing around employees.
Really?
Very.
How long ago was this?
So my last proper, if you like, contracted job was when Olivia was about
with them,
three.
With Unilever.
Yeah, so that was about 17 years ago.
Wow.
And they were, I think, now I look back, ahead of their time.
I was about to say exactly the same thing.
So their maternity policy was unbelievable. I got pretty much full pay for nearly a year. You know, they really took time to, you know, when you thought you might want to go back to work, to talk to you, to make sure it was the right time. You know, they were very good and created a job share for me. So really forward thinking. And actually, even when I was pregnant, my boss was always going, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" And I'm like, "I'm not ill. I'm pregnant," you know. And actually, you know, I had an easy pregnancy, so I was fine. But actually, that sentiment, now I look back, you know, for some women who struggle with pregnancies, it's really nice to have support and care. And you don't get that everywhere.
Where do you think that culture came from?
At Unilever?
Yeah. Because cultures, they're all different, aren't they?
They are all different.
And I just wondered, where did it come from?
I think as an organisation, they are ahead of the game on lots of things. So even then, they were starting to look at environmentally friendly things, foods that were ahead of the time. You know, that they are a forward-looking company, not just a reactive company. Who that came from, I presume it must have come from the top somewhere, whoever was leading the company.
I think you're right. I think, I mean, I don't know because I wasn't there, but in my experience, all cultures come from the top.
Yes.
It's the behaviour of the people at the top that create the culture.
Yeah.
And even if they say, we want to create this sort of culture, but don't behave like that, they're tossers, frankly.
Yeah. So it was, and I do always say to people, you know, you can't go wrong working for Unilever because they care about their employees. And then they also, just before I joined, I think they did have a time where they only employed Oxbridge graduates and then actually realised that everything they did was the same and then sort of go, oh, okay, we need to change that. And so...
Yeah. Well, that creates a culture in itself, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
So
and sorry, I've just remembered. Oh, no, go on. Yeah, yeah, had, go on. Again, ahead of their time, they had access to a therapist on site. So if people wanted... help in any respect, if they were stressed at work or whatever, you could go and see, I think she was a CBT expert.
Did anybody use it?
Yeah.
Openly? Or was it like, you know, after hours or?
No, she was based in the office. I can't honestly remember. I think those things you could do anonymously.
Yeah, it's a fantastic thing to do. Yeah. But if it's, you know, if people are whispering in corners around their coffee machine saying, oh, look, so-and-so's in there with her, you know, or whatever. That doesn't quite work, does it? Or
no,
it could put people off.
Totally. And I wasn't aware that happened. But I think, you know, now I look back, I think, gosh, they were groundbreaking in the stuff they did.
Major, magnificent organisation, actually. For all its faults, like, you know, I mean, organisations like that do.
Yeah.
But, yeah, because do you know Stuart Pickles?
I don't know him, but
he's the FD at Southcorp when I was there. He worked for Unilever.
Okay.
And honestly, everybody I've seen who I've known who's worked for Unilever is obviously very bright.
Yeah.
Very focused on.
Obviously.
Yes. Well, speaking, you know.
Yeah.
I thought actually, having said that, I wish I'd said that purposefully, but I didn't. Anyway, it makes it more meaningful.
Yeah.
But they're. Also, he, as a finance director, and he's been on the show, he's really, really concerned about people and their development and so on.
Yeah.
And that just comes through. So it's almost like you're getting a bit of culture for the rest of your career, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you asked about cultures. I will say on the other side, the retailers I work for.
Well, before we get there, because I'm very interested in going there, because we've got a common employer in that sense. So.
Yeah.
What about financial services? Maybe it was too short for you to realise or something? I don't know.
I wasn't there very long. It was more like, because actually when I accepted the job, it was based in London. And then before I joined them, they announced they were relocating to Birmingham, which is not a place I really wanted to live in. So I did go there briefly. I'm not sure. It's a bit like I would imagine the civil service to be.
really?
Yeah, quite.
Well, it's highly regulated, isn't it? So, you know.
Well, it is and it isn't.
Oh, interesting.
I don't honestly think I was long enough there
to
give you a comment on
let's
that.
Let's move on. I mean, it looks... Certainly in the banking world in the city, it looks pretty toxic. And I'm hoping to get a banker on here, actually, in a show or two's time. But
TSB, who I work for, may not have been quite the same.
No, retail, soft and cuddly. No, perhaps not soft and cuddly, but anyway, but it's speculation, isn't it? Because we don't know. So FMCG retail. And interestingly, I've got almost the same career in that sense.
Yeah.
Whereas most of mine has been FMCG, but I then had retail at Debenhams and La Senza. So, right, let's go talk about the culture at retail then.
So
you can be an open as blunt and as sweary as you like.
On the one hand, I loved the pace of retail because FMCG can be a bit slow in developing things and... moving forward. And I really noticed that when I went off maternity leave and came back and I was working on ice cream then. And I said, you know, what's happened in the last year? And they was like, well, we've launched one variety of Cornetto. And I said, what, in a whole year? And you think that's how it was. Whereas retail, I loved the fact that you could try things out in stores. If they didn't work, you could pull them.
It's easier though, isn't it? Because you've got a supplier who wants space. So all you have to do is create a bit of space, stick them in. If it works, great. If it doesn't, we get rid of them.
Absolutely. So I love that side of things. And I also love the diversity of things I worked on. So it wasn't just brand of mayonnaise, for example. It was the whole, the store, the staff, the products in the store, the, you know, it was just more diversity for me on things to work with. But the culture was definitely more high pressured and not always great if you weren't if you were struggling in any way, let's say.
Yeah, I found it awful, actually. Yeah. Particularly, yeah. Debenhams was not particularly good. It was a very political organisation, yeah. And I was there. And I was in the finance team, you know, because I'm an accountant, blah, blah, blah. And it was really toxic in there. And male, macho, hardly any women at all. Yeah. And, you know, first in, last out type of culture. You know, almost trying to score points off each other in the finance team. And you just think, oh, for Christ's sake. And I really did not like it at all. Yeah. I stuck it for 2 years, actually, but I didn't like it. Yeah. And then the Lacenza was even worse, actually. And that that's an entrepreneurial business, which was Theo Pfitis, actually.
Okay.
And then he'd sold out to private equity.
Yeah.
But the private equity culture is absolutely appalling in my experience. Have you?
Yeah, well, Homebase was...
Oh, was it?
Yes, yeah, so it was.
Okay, talk a little bit about that.
I mean, that time was strange, actually, because they were just taking money out of the company. And so we actually had a time where we sat around not doing a great deal because there wasn't the funds to do it. So things like research, like, well, we don't need to do that. We can do it ourselves. So I ended up doing bits of stuff with my department. So we would go out and interview people in stores rather than use agencies and things. So it was just a weird time because it was limbo, real limbo.
What about how people dealt with each other, though?
So prior to that, because I don't think that was a normal time, it was very, I think that because it's high pressure and you're looking at your sales week to week.
It's very short-term pressure, isn't it?
Yeah. And so I think that pressure comes down the line. And I found it much more... it was more of an environment of fear than I'd worked in before.
Well, that's not good, is it?
No, it's not good. And some people do thrive in that environment, but a lot of people don't.
Yes, at the end of the day, you do have a choice, don't you, as to whether you stay around for that sort of thing. Yeah, you're right, some people do enjoy it because they like the fight, they like winning, they like beating people up verbally, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. And I think, again, it depends which department you're in. In research, you're slightly out of that pressure because you're not on the money side of things.
You're not operational.
You're not operational. So they can cut your budgets, they can go, okay, we don't need to do that anymore, but you're not... accountable for sales, so to speak. I suppose the one area I did work in, which I found really interesting, was we did a big employee survey and I was responsible for presenting that back to the board, and some of it wasn't very complimentary. And so
about the board
honestly,
these stories like that are just coming out all the time. And it's not on, I mean, how long ago was this? This must be what, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, something.
More even.
Okay, but so these stories are still relevant today.
Yeah.
So whilst we do know it happens because people are experiencing it, actually the situation hasn't got a lot better in my experience.
To be fair on them, they commissioned it. So that in itself is a good thing because they want to know what the employees think. And some of them
got a death wish or something.
Absolutely did act on it.
Did they?
Yes, they absolutely did. You know, it's hard to tell people, you know, that their way of being, people find bullying or whatever it was. That's
aggressive,
not an easy thing to...
Aggressive, unnecessary, short.
Feedback. But there was some element of, okay, I get that, I will attempt to change. But, you know, it's all tied in with the pressure of delivering at that level. You know, so you've got that real dichotomy.
Yeah, unless they all do it.
Yeah.
What's the, you know, there is a point, but what, you know, unless the whole board does it as a collective, and then that definitely filters down. Otherwise, you end up with one bloke, you know, one member of the board treating people really nicely and another treating them badly. And, you know, you end up with internal conflict, I suspect, because of that.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
you've had lots of work experience. You're now doing the charity work, as I'd call it. It's not, but you know,
it's not. Well,
no, I do kind a little bit describe of work. So social good or something. Yeah,
social conscience.
Social conscience work. Right. Yeah. Okay. But you said a little earlier, you said that you suffer with depression, right? And I did.
I do, but I don't know whether I did say.
Oh, did you not? Oh, maybe sure. Maybe it was our pre-chat. Sure. I don't know. Yeah. But you definitely use the word suffer, mm-hmm. as I used to use the word suffer, but I now say live with, mm-hmm. because it's a part of me.
Okay.
And I don't, I'm not trying to gain sympathy, if that's mm-hmm. the right way of saying mm-hmm. it from anybody, by saying, oh, Christ, you know, I feel shit today or whatever.
Yeah.
It's, I'm living with depression. I'm not feeling so good today, but, you know, it's okay. It's part of who I am.
Yeah.
And you have that as well, as I know, which is why you're here partly, or mostly actually. Mm-hmm. At what point did you realise that you had that condition?
Okay. So just on your point of suffering, living with.
Yeah. Yes.
So I think I say suffer from because I don't have it all the time. And so I am living with it, but in pockets of time.
Oh, okay.
So that's how I see it.
Okay, so it's like you say, I'm suffering with a cold, I'm suffering with depression at this moment.
Yes.
Right, okay. Yep. Okay, so right, I understand that distinction.
The way it's impacted my life has been very much in bursts rather than a drip throughout my whole life. I'll go back to my childhood when I had anorexia quite briefly, actually, when I was around 14, 15.
God, it's such an important age, that.
Yes. And that comes back to the title of this podcast thing is,
And my book.
And your book.
And my audio book. And my speaking events.
my firm belief that depression, a lot of mental health issues come from that feeling of not being good enough.
Can you imagine how that would have been with all the social media that you've got now?
No, I often say I don't think I'd have got through those years.
Yeah.
And I can actually tell you what triggered it, because I do remember it quite well, is looking at Pans People. Do you remember Pans People?
Oh, God, yes.
And if you look back...
What was the first, the main one called? Babs? Is it Babs?
It could have been. I don't know. If you look back at clips, they were so skinny.
Yeah.
They were so, so skinny. And so I then went through this mental thing like, and I was probably slightly overweight, not, you know, just that sort of tubby phase.
Well, you're about to go through puberty,
yes,
for God's
exactly.
sake. So.
Yeah. So I then worked out, I'm not happy. To be happy, I need to be thin. That was absolutely
well, that's
the
modern day
equation.
Social media,
isn't
it?
Yeah. And actually, I did a TED talk on this as well.
So did you?
I did, yeah. TEDx talk. So all about... Well, you can
you want
have
to
a look
plug
at it.
That? Well, you've just plugged it. How do you find it?
Yeah. Under my name. I think it actually comes under Sheila Cox, Lusada, Emotional Wellbeing, Are We Failing Our Teenagers? I think is the snappy title of it.
Wow.
Yeah.
No, but that's a bloody good title, actually. Mm. Yeah. Anyway, sorry, Karen. So back to 13.
Yes. So that led to me dieting, and that dieting became obsessive, and I ended up with anorexia, which at the time there wasn't a lot known about it. I got very little help. I did go to the GP and they sort of threatened me with hospitalization. I think that was enough.
Threaten you?
Well, it was a little bit like, if you don't put on weight, you will have to go into hospital. And I think luckily at the time that was enough to trigger me into, I don't want to go to hospital, so I will start to eat a little bit more. And then I would say I had years of dysfunctional eating until I started work. And I think
you've gone through university then at this point.
Yeah. Everyone has dysfunctional eating at university.
Well, yeah, that's by par for the course. But even so, I mean, if you have got dysfunctional eating before you get there,
yes,
you've got to be careful. You've got to be really careful, I guess.
Well, I would say all of my friends and myself got very fat at university because we ate a lot of chips, drank a lot of beer and didn't really care.
Yeah.
So I went full circle and then got slimmer in the third year, then went into work. And I think you start to work out what your body needs, you know, regular exercise. I think a little bit the pressure of work, you know, takes away from thinking about food.
Yes, it does.
So that I would say was my first encounter with a mental health issue.
Did you realise what was going on? I mean, well, you know, you realised about anorexia, of course, but about the implications that might have then for you later in your life.
No. And I honestly think I didn't really think I suffered from depression until probably about, I know, it was an episode about 16 years ago when I had a real just depressive episode that I've never experienced anything like it before. And then I started to look back and go, okay, I think I've probably had these tendencies all my life, but I've managed to avoid the big deep dive that I had then.
Can you describe that?
I might read something out of this book in a minute, actually. It was like going into a deep, dark hole and thinking you would never, ever, ever come out of it. So no energy, totally lethargic. Even the thought of putting a stamp on an envelope seemed like the biggest, most momentous.
I'm smiling, and I know it's radio, you can't see me smiling, but I mean, Christ, I resonate with this, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's not, and I will read a little bit from this book, which I'm going to highly recommend to anybody who suffers from depression, because it's
lives just, with depression.
Lives or suffers from, yeah, whichever way you want to go. It's not low mood. It absolutely is not low mood. They are very different. A depressive episode is, it's a physical thing for a start. Massive chemical changes are going on in your brain, and that affects your ability to do anything.
What triggered it? Before you go to the book, which I'm really interested in, actually, what triggered it? Do you remember?
So I think for me, it's always overload and overwhelm. So this book I'm going to talk about is called Depressive Illness, The Curse of the Strong. So my way of being is to keep going, be diligent, you know, push down any feelings of not being able to cope and just soldiering on through. Come on, you know, you can keep doing. And this is going to sound really weird, but I know what the final trigger was. So it was, you know, having two young kids, also working and trying to do very big house project whilst doing all of that. And actually my husband was very ill at the time. I can't remember what it was, but he was really ill.
Did he have asthma? Was it asthma?
No, it was some viral thing. And he literally, you know, he will say he thought he was going to die at one point. So I was pretty much cooking in one of the bedrooms on a microwave because the back of the house is knocked off. Washing up in the bathroom.
I'm laughing. I shouldn't be laughing at this.
The kids were probably, I don't know, 6 and 3, something like that.
So fairly active.
Fairly active, you know, managing school and nursery and things. The house we'd bought was more of a wreck than I had anticipated, so needed loads more doing than.
Isn't that always the case?
That's always the case. And then James, when he was well, was away a lot. And I was left to deal with this house extension thing on my own. And I'd never done it before. And I'm not great at making decisions. So every day there were these massive decisions to make.
Well, if you're in a black hole,
yeah,
decision making goes out the window.
Yeah. So I think one day something went inside my brain. And that was when I just could hardly function. I mean, I did actually. At that point, I did carry on. In a way, but I wasn't sleeping, and sleep's very important to me. You know, there's that classic wake up at 4 a.m. when everything's worse anyway, couldn't get back to sleep, mulling it all over, you know. And then you get into that comparative stuff. Why can other people do this? Why, you know, it's only a house extension.
They're
why
just
can't
not good
I manage
enough again.
This? I'm not good enough, you know.
Yeah.
So I think they call comparison the thief of joy. Well, it certainly is for me. So it was everything coming together.
You see, what happens to me is very similar to that.
Yeah.
It's this, I describe it as a switch going off in my head. Yeah. It goes click like that, and then I'm gone, right? Yeah. And it's really hard to get yourself back out of the dark hole that you say you've fallen into. And it's, because I'm an accountant, I'll put it on a graph, right?
Yeah.
So you're going along on time, and the graph, your workload and your responsibilities and your pressures get higher and higher and higher, and you go up like that.
Yeah.
And then you get to the top of the hill, and rather than coming down smoothly on the other side, you go woomph.
Yes. Yeah.
And you, what is called catastrophe, you catastrophize or something, I think is what it's called psychologically. And it's that moment that you cannot stop. You're basically falling off a cliff.
Yeah.
And does that feel like how it happened to you? Because it's that woomph.
Yeah. So I teach about catastrophization to
kids,
actually.
Right.
I think personally that's a different thing. That's a style of thinking that sends you ultimately, maybe that's your style of thinking that then gets you to that point.
Yes, I agree. It is a style of thinking, but it describes still the way that it happens with me, because I'll be okay, click, and I'm gone.
Yeah. So there is a click moment. I think what I do is ignore the warning signs, because I know I've said to the GP sometimes, well, I was absolutely fine, you know, and I don't know what triggered this. When I look back, I wasn't absolutely fine. I'm kidding myself. I'm absolutely fine. And that's this thing about keeping going. Don't ask for help. That's another massive thing. And that's why this book is called The Curse of the Strong. He says that people who aren't strong don't actually get that far, because they either go, oh, I can't be bothered, I can't do this, and give up, or they ask for help. I think it's a classic thing with people who suffer depressive episodes not to ask for help.
Oh,
because, and for me, even though I know so much about this subject, I see it as a bit of a sign of weakness. And I know it's not. I know, 100% it's not. But
Lois, you can't help
it. It's very much like, I should be able to cope. I should be able to cope. Keep going. And your body's probably crying out and saying, no. And then I think it is ultimately your body saying, had enough. You know, you need to rest now. And I'm going to tell you need to rest. So it switches off. Everything switches off.
Yeah, it does. It does.
To save you, actually, from being this, you know, superwoman or superman, you know.
I've never thought of it like that before, actually, about your body telling you this is too much, switch off.
Yeah.
And the way it does it is to put you somewhere where you can't move.
Absolutely.
It's almost like a survival instinct, isn't it?
Yeah, it's like hibernation. You know, it's like
that's another interesting way of putting it.
Your body is going, you've done too much, you've tipped over a point, and you need to now rest and get better.
Is that the right time to read the bit in the book?
Possibly. It's there's a few bits in this book I could read the whole book. Honestly, I cannot recommend it highly enough on so many levels, as somebody who's suffered from depression, but also for friends and family, because he says read chapters 1 and 5, because the way he explains it is so easy to understand. And I think help, because that's, I'm sure, another conversation we can have, is how people around you can support you and how they can try and understand what's going on.
I want to get on to the impacts on family, because it's bloody immense, or can be. So, just before you start, just tell us the title of the book and who it is.
Okay, so it's called Depressive Illness, The Curse of the Strong, and it's by a man called Dr. Tim Cantifer. He's a psychiatrist. He's done other books on addictions and things, but just, it's so insightful. It's so easy to read.
And who's it published by? I think on the, if you look
it
on the back, it's
published by Sheldon Press.
Right, okay. So we know what it is. I'm looking at it now.
I can just read a quote, actually, from Jeremy Vine. It just said, in the response to his Radio 2 broadcast, if the response to his Radio 2 broadcast is anything to go by, Tim Cantifer is saying something uniquely powerful to people with depression. People affected by depression tell me this is the most powerful and helpful book ever written on the topic. I keep meeting people who say this book changed their lives. So that's a pretty powerful testimonial.
You say you've given me a copy, but I can't find it.
I'm sure I did.
No, I'm going to have to go and get
another. I'll buy you another copy.
No, you won't. No, I shall go and get another one.
So anyway, I'm just going to read this. It's just about how depression is positioned.
Positioned in what way? Inside the person or?
No, how it's described and how people view
okay.
the term.
Okay.
So,
okay, yeah, right.
So he said, part of the problem is the name. Depression sounds like how I feel on a Monday morning, but in reality, it isn't even close. The one is a relatively mild and transient disturbance of emotion, the other a serious illness causing immense suffering. There are many pieces of unhelpful advice to which sufferers of depressive illness are prone to be exposed. The commonest and possibly the worst is pull yourself together. If the sufferer could have pulled himself together, he would have done so ages ago. And as you will read later, he is not the type to shirk challenges. In any case, what do you think the object of this stunning gem of advice was? Do you really think that he's going to put his hand on his brow and gasp, gosh, thank you so much, I hadn't thought of that. Thank goodness you told me. I'll just go off and sort myself out and then everything will be fine. I think not. So
I'm smiling and laughing because yeah, that is just true. People overuse that word. They use it as yes. hyperbole and yes. don't get anywhere near
yes.
the depth of feeling that, yeah. that can happen.
Yeah, and that depth of feeling, you know, worst case, makes you not want to be here. You know, and I'm going to be really honest that...
Do, please.
I have felt that, you know, it's not that you want to really do anything. It's just the pain is so bad. You don't want to be around anymore. And that's not logical. And that's even harder for people like us who have on the outside really lovely lives with, you know, very privileged in lots of ways. We've got good jobs. We've got lovely families. We've got lovely houses. And that's what's hard sometimes. People understand you. They yeah. go, well, what have you got to be depressed about?
Oh, I know, yeah. There is a distinct distinction
yeah.
between somebody who has a medical condition about called depression yeah. and somebody who's just feeling a bit low.
Yeah.
And the two are just, they shouldn't have the same word
no.
used
no.
to describe them.
No.
So you we've often spoken about this, actually, mm-hmm. and you've always said, what's the point?
Yeah.
Yeah. And James, your husband, has used that about yeah. sometimes how you describe when you're in a particular low. And that, yeah. that's referring, I think, to what you've just said, isn't
yeah.
it?
Yeah. So your question is?
I haven't got a question.
You haven't got a question.
No, it's just a yes. Just.
It's just that sense of, you know, going, and this is what, you know, that switch thing is, you can sort of feel fine one day and then the next day, and this is what's the hardest thing about it, the next day wake up in such a different mood that it's scary how quickly it happens to go, actually yesterday, and sometimes I journal because I want to understand how my brain and my thoughts change. So I can be like, you know, really motivated and happy one day, and then the next day, something like a switch has gone, and I just don't want to be here.
Does it happen in real time, or is it? Do you have to have a night's sleep or a bit of a rest before you wake up and think, I feel shit today?
It's normally, I'm not a great morning person anyway. I don't love mornings. So, yeah, it would normally be in the morning.
Right, because, I mean, that's happened to me occasionally where I've woken up and I cannot get out of bed,
yeah.
literally cannot get out of bed.
Yeah.
And I've said this before, but when Charlie was born and coming home from hospital,
yeah.
I could not get out of bed to go and yeah. pick him up. Yeah. And I'm, bloody hell, how shamed am I for that? I was shameful. But I just could not do it.
So I'm going to ask you some questions.
Yeah,
now.
Yeah,
when you
go
look
for it.
Back at that, because there's a lot more evidence now for men having postnatal depression. Do you think...
No.
You don't?
No, no. Because I know the feeling that I had then, because I've had it before,
okay.
and I've had it since as
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
And but
so, what do you think was going on then?
I think I'd had a bad night's sleep.
Yeah.
I'd probably drunk too much.
Yeah.
Sue was in hospital having a hysterectomy. That's not the right word, is it?
Cesarean.
Cesarean. That's
yeah.
the word.
Yeah.
So she couldn't. You know, she couldn't drive.
Mm.
Right. William was at school and Granny was staying with us
mm-hmm.
and her husband, my father-in-law, Sue's
yeah.
father, died
yeah.
a month earlier.
Okay.
So there was a lot of
yeah.
emotional bouncing yeah. around during that time. And And I actually think it was the alcohol and lack of sleep that really did it.
Okay.
And I've subsequently learned that alcohol is not good for sleep.
No.
And I'm starting to drink less, you'll be pleased to hear, but I haven't quite got there yet.
Okay.
But I think it was that. It was just that it all came together and yeah. click, it happened.
Yeah.
And I remember being on my best mate's wedding.
Yeah.
And the same thing happened the day he was getting married, actually. And I it was the day after he got married. I could not get out of bed, and I eventually surfaced around 6 o'clock in the evening. You know, and it's so debilitating and knocks you sideways.
Again, coming back to this book, it's quite interesting because he is talking about a particular type of depression, which he calls stress-induced depression. And that is definitely what happens to me, is when everything comes together in like a melting pot and explodes. So it's layer upon layer of things rather than one thing. And I think that may...
Is there a bit of straw with the camel's back there, do you think? You get to that point where you just think... Ugh.
I just think, for me, it's just mental overload. Plus, and this is now I'm doing more work in this area, not dealing with my feelings. So pushing everything down, pretending it's all okay, rather than going, actually, I feel a bit sad today. What can I do about that? I go, feeling a bit sad today, push that back. I'm fine, I can carry on. And the more I've done it, work in this area, the more a lot of mental health comes from not acknowledging your feelings and not dealing with them.
Yes.
And those feelings, you know, around fear, stress, shame, all of that stuff.
Yeah, guilt, blah, 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 goes on and on. Because there's a slight difference for me, because I can be fine, literally fine, and not have any of the other stuff going on around. And somebody will say something just with the wrong, slightly the wrong tone, and click, I've gone, my switch has gone off, and then I'll disengage, I'll go into a place where nobody else is, and that can happen in a pub with my mates.
Yeah.
Could
be that it's triggering very much the heart of your belief. So I'm not sure I get that to the same degree, but I think what might be happening with you is somebody says something and you're going, I'm not good enough. That just proves it.
Subsequently, having gone through a bit of therapy, and like you, going back to when I was 13, 14, at boarding school being bullied, that's the sort of thing that happened. Yeah. And it sort of triggers you back to that moment, I'm not good enough. Yeah. I don't deserve to be here. Mm. And then it comes back to your what's the point moment.
But that also triggers a type of behaviour that is constantly trying to make yourself good enough. So you work harder, you do more, you achieve more to try and get that validation. Yeah. And actually, it doesn't work.
Well, it doesn't work because it puts you in another place, doesn't it? It puts you in the same place yet again. So you go on this cycle of ups and this wave of peaks and troughs, and the troughs can be bloody seriously troughy, and the peaks can actually be okay. I would say they're not terribly peaky.
Yeah.
But you said something a little earlier about not heeding the warning signs.
Yeah.
And that you've worked on how you do that. Because I've been doing the same thing for the last 2 or 3 years, actually.
Yeah.
So I'd be interested to hear what you've done to sort of spot it coming.
So I think I'm still not great at spotting it coming. And I had an episode earlier this year and I didn't see it coming, and it was possibly the worst one I've had.
Really?
Yep.
Because it lasted a long time, didn't it? It was months, wasn't it? Weeks.
About 6 weeks.
Yeah.
If I look at my step count on my phone, because I walked my way through it, about 6 weeks. I think there were warning signals, and I ignored them. What I think I'm getting better at is putting things in place in my life that help me not get to that place in the first place.
Like what?
Yoga. So anything that I do through my body. So I've tried bits of meditation over the years, and I find it really hard to clear my mind. So one of my big things is mind chatter. I'm constantly ruminating, mulling things over. It never stops.
But practice, because I have that trouble, and my therapist said, just keep trying, and eventually you will get to that point.
Well, I think there are various theories on it. Some people, I think you need to think broader than meditation is sitting on a cushion and just trying
cross,
to clear
cross
your mind.
Legs, fingers together. It's not
my
that,
yoga
it?
Teacher said very few people can do that straight off. They have to do meditation through movement, and that can be so. Me doing yoga is an amazing way of calming my mind because I'm focusing on the positions I'm getting into, not what's going on in my head. So for me, yoga is my meditation.
Yeah,
and
well, that's fine.
But other people, painting. You know, anything that gets your attention on an activity where you're in what we call flow is a form of meditation. And I went on an NLP course recently.
NLP, what's that?
Neuro-linguistic programming. I'm not going to go into it, but it was very good,
good
course.
Good, because I wouldn't be able to talk about that.
However, one of the activities we did was called, it was either conscious or unconscious dancing. And we had 2 hours in a village hall. It's also called Five Rhythms Dancing. And no talking, no real interacting with the other people.
Thank God for that.
A little bit, but not a lot. And they take you through various states of being. So the music takes you on a journey through flow. One of them is called chaos. And all the different types of music evoke a different style of dancing in you. But it's very free flow. You don't need...
Is it free form?
Free form, yeah. Right. I mean, just do what you like. Some people go absolutely mad and shout and scream. Other people hardly move. At the time, I was thinking, oh, God, what am I doing this for? You know, another thing I'm trying out.
Sounds hippie-ish to me.
The next day, I have never had such a clear head in my life.
Really?
Unbelievable. So anything like that, I think anything that works for you is worth trying, having a go at, you know. Yeah. So I'm gonna definitely try that again. Walking is a big thing for me.
You hit the nail on the head there. Find something that works for you.
Yeah.
And don't expect to be able to do it continually, immediately, because I can't remember who it was said. Somebody said it takes 66 days for something to become a habit.
A new habit, yeah.
Whereas people take New Year's resolutions and expect to be doing it by Tuesday. Yeah. You know? It just doesn't work. Yeah. So pick one. Do that and just focus on doing that, and suddenly you'll realize actually this is part of my lifestyle,
absolutely.
And you can then start something else maybe. Mm. And even if you drop off one, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
But just get something that works for you, not what somebody said in a well-being manual or a class at work or a well-being workshop.
Yeah.
You know, that's bollocks, frankly, as far as I'm concerned, is you have to do your own research and find what works for you. And that's what you've done.
And that's what I do. And this is also what I teach the kids because, I teach them lots of things, but I have one module on coping. And what I do is I show them a first aid kit for physical health things. And what we then do is develop their own first aid kit for mental health.
Oh, what do they come up with?
Oh, everything from, you know, pets come up a lot. I could talk a lot about the mental health.
You've got Teddy.
I've got Teddy.
Yeah.
You know, just stroking a cat or a dog or a pet releases hormones happier.
I do want a dog and I don't want a dog, but the thought of having a little doggy sat on my lap watching telly and you're just stroking and he's just sleeping or just, you know, just enjoying it and... I don't know what dogs. What's the equivalent of purring in dogs?
Oh, just being. They're just
being.
Just being.
Totally relaxed and warm. You just think, Christ, that would be fantastic. Yeah.
And we can learn a lot from dogs because they're very mindful creatures.
Yes,
so
they
everything they do is in the moment. In the moment.
That's
so
an
else?
Important point. Yeah, I'm going to write that down because we might come back to that. Yeah,
kids
go on.
Do. Oh, lots of things. So music comes up quite a lot. Playing music, listening to music, sport. You know, for boys, stress. A lot of them have stress things and widget things that they take to school with them. Talking. So I always, that's my one, and that's, there's some irony in the fact that my company is called Good Talk Coaching. And it's really taken me until this episode of depression before I've really opened up to people. Because before I was like, I can't tell people. It's like my shame secret, I can't tell people.
Honestly, I cannot believe that.
So I did tell people a little bit before, but I was really selective.
You told James, didn't you? Do you always tell James?
I've always told James, yeah. Because he's very emotionally intelligent and he can cope with that. And that was said in real irony because he's not. But you can't actually live with somebody and not tell
yeah,
them.
Yeah, James is one of my best mates, actually. He's in my top five. I'm not yeah. telling you which number he is, but yeah. we've known each other for, as long as I've known you. So, yeah.
But that's a whole other topic. How do you communicate to somebody who's never suffered from, lived with, what you're going through, because you can't see it. You cannot see it.
No.
And I've actually said to him, I feel like putting a sign around my neck going, I just feel terrible. I feel, you know, or we did actually, one thing we did have, which is a useful thing in a couple, is a number system. So rather than having to ask someone every day, how are you, and go into the details, it's like, what number are you? So if I'm a one, I'm having a really, really bad day. Or if I'm an eight or a nine, I'm fine.
Yeah.
And that's a real shortcut.
Do you do that every day?
No.
I
and
do.
Like all things, we've got out of the habit. But when I'm
But you could. You could do it. And it would be fine. Because Alistair Campbell does that. He has 0 to 10, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And he was on this show earlier on. And
yeah.
I'm now doing that. I'm now, because I said to him, do you monitor how you feel? He says, no. And it's a little bit of, you know, because you can tend to see the patterns if he's actually getting worse or better or whatever.
Yeah.
And I now do that and I monitor myself. But I get down to two.
Mm-hmm.
Occasionally, I've never been a one because one is bloody serious shit down there.
I think I've been a one.
Have you?
Yeah.
Have you? No, I'm lucky I haven't. So I've been a two, and quite recently I've been a two. And I think when you had your episode before, that was probably a one actually, wasn't it?
At its worst, it was a one.
Yeah. And But I've never been above seven. And I think I've only been a seven twice.
Mm.
So I tend to hover between five and six.
Yeah.
And there's a mate of mine who hovers between nine and ten.
Mm.
Bastard.
There is total envy for people that go through life never experiencing any of this. Because it's really hard. It's really draining. But it tells you stuff, you learn from it.
Talk to me a bit more about opening up, though. Because not opening up, you see, I have opened up a lot more about it.
Yeah.
In fact, I'm probably on the boring side now.
Mm.
Somebody I just meet, I'll say, I live with depression. You know?
Yeah.
And I'll tell them because, and it's quite interesting because a number of people then who come back and say, oh, yeah, so do I actually. Or somebody in my family does. So there's a connection there.
Yeah.
So why, and you, I mean, you're a girly, you know, I mean, girls are bloody good at doing this, men are not.
That's very stereotypical.
Of course it is.
I've just written off
50% of the world's population.
Girls are good at talking. They're not always good at admitting when things aren't going right. Well, sorry, me particularly, because I think I've created this persona where I am strong, I cope, you know, I've achieved da 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 da, and I don't want people to think I'm not that person. So it's all tied in with that. This time I knew I couldn't do it on my own. I absolutely knew I needed help. So I did cherry pick the people I told, and it's much easier to tell people that have been through it themselves.
Yeah. Well, you told me, didn't you?
Sadly, I know quite a lot of people that have.
Yeah.
It's not uncommon. It really isn't.
No.
It's much harder to tell people who haven't been through it because it, you know, like when I talk to James, he tries to understand, but he can't really step in my shoes.
No, he can't comprehend the seriousness and the depth of what it is you're feeling.
Yeah. It's not that he's not supportive, he is, but I can see the fear because it's not something he feels comfortable with and he doesn't know
how to help me. When he speaks to me about it, about your situation, and particularly when you went through this last period, he's really supportive, and he admits that he doesn't quite understand it, but he knows that you're having a really tough time, and he's really good about it, actually.
He is, he is really supportive. Personally, I find my friends that have experienced it a better support, just because the one thing they kept saying to me is, you will get through this, even though in the moment you absolutely don't see how you can ever pull yourself out of this hole.
Yeah, there's a book, isn't there? It Will Pass or something.
It Will Pass. There's another brilliant book, which I highly recommend as well. And I think it's called The Recovery Letters. And it's written by people who've suffered, had depression, come out of it. And it's writing to people who are in depression at the moment. And it's so brilliant because they're all going through their experiences, but then saying, look, I'm still here. I did get through it. You won't feel like you'll ever get out of it, but you will.
Yeah.
So it's having that hope and
I deliberately use the word live with depression, and I know we've just had a conversation about that, but that's because I know that all I have to do is wait, right? Because if I haven't got any energy to do anything, I'm not going to do anything.
Yeah.
So I have to wait, and I have to get through it, and then bit by bit, you'll see little green shoots of hope, and that's the point at which you start walking or you start doing something. So I think the fact that you, when you were right in the midst of it, you were still walking and walking your way through it. Wow.
I think I just made myself, you know, it was like, I'm not going to feel better just lying in bed. And I'm not a person who likes lying in anyway. So I knew that was going to make me worse. So I just thought, no, you put one foot in front of the other.
Yeah.
And I've got a dog.
Yes,
you know,
that helps.
So that's another reason.
Yeah, you have to go out, don't you?
And I use that time to ring friends, to listen to podcasts, normally around anything around depression. That's the other really weird thing. The only thing I can read when I'm in that zone is anything to do with mental health. I can't read novels, and I'm a big reader. I can't read newspapers. I can only read books about depression, which, again, I think is my way of processing it.
Yeah,
going,
it will be, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, you're not the only one that's been through this. You will get through it.
Yeah, Christ, that's exactly a description of how I feel, because I've always struggled with words to describe it. And particularly when you're in it, you know, everybody says, well, why don't you write down how you feel? I bloody can't.
No, can't do anything.
No, one, because I just can't do anything. Yeah. And two, because I haven't got the language or the vocabulary to do it.
Yeah.
And then when the moment's gone, I don't actually want to go back there.
Mm.
So I never do it. Which is, it's not stupid, is it? No, because I have other ways of which I deal with it, actually.
And apart from the fact that you feel you've got no energy and you can't do anything, there's no outward physical symptoms that you are depressed. And I think that's what other people struggle with and what I struggle with, because I want to just grab someone and go, I feel awful.
Yeah.
You know, you can't see this, but if you could see inside my head, this is just hell. It's hell on earth. That's the only way I can describe
it.
It is hell.
Did you ever have experiences like that when you were at work?
No. No, you see, work is my salvation.
Yeah. But even when you were working in the retail businesses or anything like that?
No. I actually didn't really get depression when I worked.
Wow. Because you see, that for me, that's triggered it, actually, when you got wankers treating you like shit and being aggressive and bullying because they felt they could and nobody called out the bad behaviour. That, I mean, if that's going to make me feel not just good enough, well, bloody hell, you know.
Touch wood, I didn't have that. And I actually think I've been very lucky in my life with my human connections in work and outside of work. I've generally worked with really lovely people. So maybe if I had had that, it would have triggered something.
Yes, that's interesting. Mind you worked for James for a bit. That's bad enough.
Bizarrely, we actually worked together very well.
Did you?
We did.
Oh, I couldn't work with Sue. Bloody hell. Could you work with him now?
I think, yeah.
Could
I
you?
Mean, we did actually. We were staying away, going to a friend's party, and we had a strategy session in a coffee shop the other day, talking about the company he works for now. And actually, yeah, we work well together.
God, I couldn't. No, Sue and I were on different planets when it comes to that, unfortunately.
We did, really, yeah.
I'm envious of that, actually, because I would quite like to work with Sue, you know, because, I mean, we do very few things together at the moment, you know.
He doesn't always listen to me.
No, but that's...
But, yeah,
I've got to say that's not the point, but that is the point, actually. Right. So, apart from walking
mm-hmm.
and wanting to shout to people. Actually, I'm going to come back to that bit about wanting to shout to people because it's invisible.
Yeah.
I reckon I can spot somebody who is depressed.
Do you?
Yeah, because you can see it in their eyes. Because there is a lack of eye contact, which we're having a lot of at the moment. Yeah. There's a vacancy in their eyes. They're not responding particularly well. And everybody thinks, oh, he's a grumpy old git, isn't he? But actually, I don't think that's the case. It is sometimes, but I think you can spot the behaviour because I know what it feels like and I think I can see it in other people.
So I think I can in some people. I'm not sure people would always see it in me because I'm, as I said to people, I'm a very good actress. So even when I'm in the depths of it, I'm very smiley. I will pretend everything's okay. Unless somebody asks, and we've talked about this, you know, when somebody says, how are you? And you say, fine. If that person goes a bit further and says, how are you really doing? Then that sometimes gives you the opportunity to open up a little bit more.
You see, I think that last bit is particularly important for somebody who you know.
Yes.
And you can spot that they're not good. Yeah. You know, if they're at work, they're at a desk or something, and they're, you know, they're keeping their head down.
Yeah.
You know, they're not interacting with people, whereas normally they'd go and get a round of coffees or something, and they're not doing that. You know, you can just tell. There's little telltale signs, which if you don't experience depression, you're not going to spot. You just think they're having an off day, but actually it's probably more than an off day.
Yeah.
But yeah, how are you really is a good opener to somebody to, and I've not used that yet. Didn't we see that guy at the Literature Festival in Cheltenham that he talked about that?
I mean, I've used it, and I think James started to use it in lockdown maybe. I remember him talking about it in one of the companies he worked for. So, you know, these things are gradually coming into businesses now, but
it's too slow. But I've said before about the, you know, civil rights thing, you know, we're sort of broadly getting there.
Yeah.
And that started in the 60s, last century. So, you know, we're talking 60 years to get it to this point. We've got a hell of a long way to go, I think.
Yeah.
And the more that we talk about it, the better.
Yeah.
So, apart from walking and yoga.
Yeah.
What else do you do?
Talking.
Yeah.
Being open about what's going on in my head, not pretending. There is an element that the work I do helps me because I read around the topic a lot. I'm constantly updating myself on what's happening in this world in positive psychology. I am part of a charity called Action for Happiness, which is an amazing organisation. Honestly, I've been involved since they set up, which is, I can't remember, quite a long time ago now. But they are there to promote happiness in the world. And somebody called Richard Layard, who I think is an ex-politician, or he's certainly an economist, he's done lots of work looking at GDP and happiness and the link. And, you know, he said once countries reach a certain level of GDP, the increase in happiness is minor. And yet that's what we're all chasing all the time, this, you know, linear increase. And we should be looking at well-being and happiness. So he actually comes at it from an economic point of view. And then they just do loads of work around every month there's a different topic in the calendar. So it's optimistic October at the moment.
Very good.
Do lots of activities. I'm part of a local group, and we meet once a month and we do a bit of meditation and we talk really openly, and it's real eclectic mix of people. Honestly, there's so interesting, all ages, all backgrounds, and people just lay their soul, you know, it's so supportive.
I'd find that really difficult. Group sessions. I just think, oh Christ, I can't do it. One to one, I'm fine.
Mm.
You know, you get me in a pub and a couple of pints, I'll talk for England.
Yeah.
But when it's a group session, I just think, what the fuck am I doing?
Have
here?
You ever tried it?
No.
Really? So how can you? You see, I am just such a big fan of group stuff. One, because you realise you're not alone. And that's a big thing. And two, so my Hoffman course that I did, the benefit of that is one, because you dedicate a whole week to yourself, but also in that week, you develop very strong bonds with people who become a massive support to you and give you that, it sounds a bit cheesy, but group love. It's such a powerful thing to go through.
Yeah, you see, because I mean, as you know, I go to the theatre on my own.
Yeah.
And last night I moved seats. I wasn't sat next to anybody. Right. And I love being anonymous in a pub on my own, just because I can just sit there, no hassles, no pressures, yeah. Have my own thoughts, yeah. And read a paper, read a book, listen to a bit of something, yeah. You know. And the thought of being with somebody, because I hate silence when I'm with somebody. So, and with one person, it's odd that, because one person you're more likely to have a silence than you are in a group.
Yeah.
But then when you are splitting up, the group's splitting up, and you're going to get a cup of coffee or whatever it is, and you're stuck with one person, I feel this immense pressure to keep the conversation going.
Mm.
And that's when, you know, you're saying about acting.
Yeah.
I do. I hide behind my personality.
Yeah.
And what that does is it costs me a lot when it's finished.
Yeah.
Because that's, I'm trying to be something I'm not, or I'm not feeling.
Yeah.
And so you end up, and that's the start of the spiral downwards, actually.
Yeah.
So the thought of being in a group session and then splitting up and saying, you know, break into partners or something, you know, it would just fill me with horror. For me, it just doesn't work. I suppose it doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, I like to be on my own a lot of the time. I'm quite independent, and, you know,
I think later on
I'm
going
to go wandering around London. I'll be in my element, just looking at people. I don't need to interact with them. But I really think there's a time and place for honest sharing, and sometimes it's about helping other people. So I know
that's different.
I can say something in those groups that will help another person. I also know if I'm not in a great place and I go to those meetings, somebody will say something or recommend something that will be a benefit to
me. You said earlier, I don't like asking for help. And I don't. I would much rather talk about your situation than mine, although because we're in the similar position, so it's been a bit more even.
Yeah.
But I would, I would much, much rather talk about somebody else.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you get somebody who loves talking about themselves, they're boring, actually.
Yeah.
But if you're genuinely interested in them, I get more out of that by being empathetic than I would them telling them about my stuff and them coming back to me as being empathetic.
Yeah, I think for me it's more that type of activity is more about community as well, and feeling like I've got a community of people that are like-minded, that are interested in this stuff, that share what's going on in their life without an agenda. You know, there's no egos in that room.
Yeah, I like the bit about without an agenda, but I've got a little MG, and it would be like me joining the MG Owners Club.
Isn't it going back to your toolkit, you know, your first aid kit, what works for you
exactly,
and what works for me. And that's so important for people because actually that's another way you can end up being hard on yourself, because you think, oh, well, so depressed people or people who have depression need to meditate, and then you're no good at it, or you think you're no good at it. That's another way to beat yourself up.
Yes.
And doesn't help. So it really is. I think mental health and understanding mental health is so still in its infancy. So you, unfortunately, as the individual, have to work with yourself and go, right, what works for me?
So I shouldn't be so disparaging about group sessions, should I? Because I'm actually...
No, you shouldn't, Chaz. Absolutely not, because it's a lifeline for some people.
Don't tell me off. It makes me feel bad.
Yeah.
But no, I shouldn't, because it works for some people.
Yeah.
And here I am espousing all this stuff about find what works for you.
Yeah.
And then I'm saying, well, I wouldn't do that. It's no goody good.
Mm.
I should say, oh, really?
Yeah.
And I should be more open-minded about
it. You should. And I think that's what I have become, is very open-minded about anything. I will, you know, I'll give anything a go, because if it works, why wouldn't you?
Yes, I don't think I'm quite at that point yet.
Right.
I am giving lots of stuff a go.
Yeah.
And I do quite a lot of stuff now.
Yeah.
But have I expanded my boundaries to look at what everything else that is available? No, I haven't.
So what do you do that helps you?
Well, I do I'm thinking more about sleep. I'm mm-hmm. thinking more about less alcohol. Yeah. I do meditate. I do breathing sessions.
Yeah.
I did one on the train on the way in, actually, mm-hmm. Just because I could.
Yeah.
Yeah. I spend more time thinking about noise. So mm-hmm. you just shut yourself off
yeah.
and think about the noises that are going on around you. Like now I can hear a humdrum of a air conditioner or yeah. something in the background.
Yeah.
And what else do I do? Diet is mm-hmm. really important. So I'm careful about what I eat
yeah.
in terms of, well, anyway, just getting a balanced diet because
yeah. yeah.
alcohol, poor diet, lack of sleep are really shit for you.
Yeah.
I do, and I've said this before on this show, about Michael Mosley's Just One Thing.
Yeah.
But being an accountant, of course, I tally them all up and graph it yeah. and make sure I'm still doing yeah. them and so on. But because they're so bloody easy, mm. you know, and do they genuinely give me a benefit? If I'm honest, I probably don't know.
Mm.
But it does make me feel better. So I've yeah. had my yogurt drink this morning.
Yeah.
I've
yeah.
had a, this is a really tough one, I've had a piece of chocolate, right? I've had a coffee.
Yeah.
Before I met you, I had yeah. a caf coffee and yeah. I've now had a decaf coffee as well.
Yeah.
I eat beetroot, mm. you know, I mean, really, really easy. Drink water, mm. you know, eat an apple.
Yeah.
So, so easy. And yeah. these are the things I was thinking, you know, saying that you can pop yourself into as a habit.
Yeah. And those are what I call the hygiene factors that we should all be doing anyway.
And then, oh, no, that's true. And then, yes.
You know, things like the breathing. Oh,
I'm feeling
stuff.
I'm feeling guilty now. I'm feeling shameful because I'm only doing hygiene factors.
No, when I work with kids, you know, the first thing I talk to them are things like diet and sleep because those are often the two reasons why they're not feeling great or they're tired in lessons and whatever. So you start with that, get everyone to the same level on that, and then you do the other stuff like the breathing, like the meditation, like whatever else.
Oh, I see. Right.
You.
Okay. So what I'm doing is
so you're
not
doing
bad.
A mixture.
I am because yeah. it's just. Yeah. I don't see why I shouldn't. You know, well, I'm not going to drop yeah. anything unless it just sort of happens yeah. to drift out of mm-hmm. my. I mean, I haven't had an apple for a week now because I've had a tooth infection. I can't eat the bloody yeah. thing. So,
yeah.
but I will start that again next week. Yeah. But I've started having a bath before oh. bed.
Oh, that is one of the things that comes up with kids actually a lot is in their first aid kit, a nice shower or a bath. They love it.
Shower's not right. Shower's not enough.
Well,
you need yeah. to, for me, I shouldn't
yeah.
say that.
Yeah.
For me, a shower is not enough at mm. night now.
Mm.
It's about sitting in a bath for 10 or 15 minutes,
yeah.
getting really warm and hopefully yeah. relaxed. I do a bit of breathing there as well, and I shut my eyes mm. and I try and do, I don't know if I'm meditating or not, but mm. I think I am.
Well, it's self-care. That's what it comes down to.
I think, yes,
to,
that's a good yeah. way of putting it. And then I'll get into bed and I'll lie back and I'll try and relax every muscle in my body and realise I can't.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just these things that don't cost you anything, really. But the overall benefit is yeah. huge, potentially, yeah. particularly if you're doing lots of them and yeah. you don't notice because it's yeah. habitual.
On the alcohol front.
Oh, yeah. I don't know why I said it like that.
No, because you said you're drinking less or
trying to drink
less.
Yeah.
Do you know what role alcohol plays in your life?
Silence is on radio is not good, is it? I don't know that I've ever really thought about it before. I do know it plays quite a big role because certainly during 18 to 40... there was a huge amount of alcohol
yeah.
drunk. And I think yeah. that's our generation. It was.
Oh, absolutely.
It was like that. Yeah. And my kids, and I guess your kids as well, I hope or suppose, that they hardly drink alcohol at all, which...
Mine do, but that generation generally don't drink
no,
as much.
No, right? And Charlie hardly drinks anything. William hardly drinks anything. I mean, if they do go out, they might have a skinful, but, you know,
yeah.
Christ, that's fine, you know, every yeah. once in a while. But yeah, I know I'm drinking too much. I'm mm-hmm. certainly well above the recommended yeah. dosage. And I don't think it helps my weight. And weight is the absolutely underlying cause of everything for me, I mm-hmm. think. But yeah, I still drink it because actually I enjoy it.
Mm. Well, the reason I ask is because you know I stopped drinking.
Yes, I do
five
know.
Years ago. And yeah. I think my realization then was I had started to drink to dull pain rather than drink to enhance pleasure, and they're two really different things. And I also grew up in a time where, you know, we just everyone drank loads and it was part of going out and partying.
Yeah.
And then I fell into that sort of every day having a glass of wine, 6 o'clock, bit bored.
Talk me through the lead up to that moment, because I know exactly how my pattern of thought and feelings go in the lead up to 6 o'clock, which then became 5:30, which then became 5. Yeah. So just, can you describe that?
I think it partly started when I had kids, and I adore my kids and it's the best thing I've ever done in my life by far. However, there is some monotony that goes with having small kids, and you know, you've got your routines.
Get them into bed. Oh, thank Christ for that.
Yeah, there's, you know, then get back from school, do homework, give them a bath, and then it's like a reward. You know, I've got through the day, I can relax now. So it was a habit, but then I think further down the line, and I think this is possibly linked to the depressive episodes, I then use it as a way to escape my feelings.
What kind of urge do you get for it? Because I
now
I,
or then,
well, any either.
Well, I don't drink now, so well, the urge was habitual. It was a bit like, oh, it's, you know, watching the clock.
I get a craving. I get a oh Christ, I could do the drink, and it actually doesn't matter what the time is, and that's why it was getting earlier and earlier and earlier because the craving was coming on earlier.
Yeah.
And what I do now is, I'll even get to the point where I'll go and pick up the bottle of wine and I'll just say to myself, no, I'll put it down and I'll walk away. And I'm doing that more and more. Mm. So quite often I'll just go into the bloody utility room and open the fridge. I mean, what the fuck am I doing that for? And I'll say, no, you don't need that biscuit. And just shut the door. So that little saying no does me a power of good, actually.
Yeah, I think, again, I think it's slightly different for me. I think when I got into problem drinking, it was more that I just wanted to dull the pain of, I think I was going through a phase, I was a bit bored, I was a bit lonely, and drink took the edge off that. And that became more and more habitual to the point that I drank every day, not loads. You know, people have said, oh, you didn't have a problem with drink. I didn't drink that much, but my relationship with drink wasn't healthy.
Yeah, I've never evaluated mine, actually.
And then I also, I'm a bit all or nothing. So I used to smoke, and in trying to give up smoking, I realised I could never do that little social smoking thing. I either smoked or I didn't. And I sort of came to that conclusion with drinking, that for me, it would be easier to not drink at all than go through that thing, which I think a lot of our generation do, is, well, I'm not going to drink Monday to Thursday, but by Friday. And they were all talking about, oh, Friday, can I have a drink? And I just thought, I don't want to live my life like waiting for that drink.
No,
and then easier to go, well, I don't drink.
And then you go over the top as well.
Yeah.
And it makes the weekends worse. So no, I don't abide by that. But what I have started doing is drinking Guinness Zero.
Yeah.
Because it tastes bloody good. It's very close to the original. Yeah. So I drink that at home, which makes me sleep so much better.
Yeah.
But if I go out, I'm going to have a drink. Mm. I'm going to have the first part. It's Adrian Charles. He's written a book, hasn't he, about drinking, his relationship with alcohol.
Yeah.
You know, the first pint, I relate to this so much. The first pint is absolutely gorgeous. You think the second is going to be the same and it isn't.
Yeah.
And then the third is just, oh, for God's sake.
Yeah.
So I generally tend to stop on three.
Yeah.
It would be very rare for me to go beyond that, which at my age is enough anyway, actually. But I don't want to go out and not drink because that whole pub environment, as we were saying earlier, is absolutely crucial to almost my well-being, actually.
Well, luckily, some of the non-alc products are really good.
They're fantastic.
And the reason I sort of raised that is because we talked about, you know, you didn't really like group things. Well, I'm saying that in relation to stopping drinking. You know, some people swear by AA and think it's the best thing ever, and I know it really works for people. And I went to one meeting with a friend and we were just laughing because we were like, this is so not for us. But there's other organisations now like Club Soda and Soberistas that are much more positive in the way they talk about
I think I've been prejudiced by AA, actually, and all the bits of, you know, the things you see on the telly where in part of a drama they'll go to AA, you know.
And it is quite negative and it's quite controlling in its way of, you know, their view is you're always an addict, you know, you're only like 1 minute away from having another drink. So I think you then must live your life in fear, whereas things like club soda are much more like, you know, the benefits of giving up are X. There's some great non-alcoholic products out there and you can still go to the pub and you can still enjoy life to the same degree. So I'm much more akin to
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no,
way
it's good. It's good. I'm
just waiting for all my generation to also give up, and then it would be a lot easier because we'd all be giving up, teetotal.
This sounds really odd, but I'm not far off doing that, actually, funnily enough. Because I went to the pub the other day, actually, right? And I deliberately drove.
Yeah.
And I chose this pub to meet a couple of mates, knowing it had Guinness Zero in it. Mm-hmm. And I drank nothing but Guinness Zero, all night, because we were only there for two drinks. And it actually made no difference to the conversation, to the difference whatsoever. Yeah. And I'm thinking, well, if every pub sold Guinness Zero, I'd probably go in and just drink that and I'd have no alcohol. So in a sense, I'd be doing what you're doing.
Yeah. So I still go to pubs. And actually one of the best holidays I ever had was an alcohol-free retreat. And there was 8 or 9 women, didn't know them before. We had an absolute ball. Obviously no alcohol all week, but we laughed non-stop.
But you're on the same wavelength,
exactly,
aren't you? Because you must get to the point where, you know, if you're in a pub for 3 hours or whatever, and you're having a meal maybe, the conversation will drift away from you, won't it? And I mean, how do you deal with that? You just think, oh, for God's sake, he's off on one again or whatever.
I think over the years my social life has changed a bit, so I pick and choose what I go to and who's there. And I actually think I've sort of inspired quite a few friends to cut down their drinking.
Well, you've inspired me to do it, actually.
So there's fewer and fewer people of my age now that get absolutely plastered. And so I'm less and less in that arena where someone is really drunk and repeating themselves all the time.
You see, I get excited by drinking. Yeah. Sessions. So, for example, at the races last year, I was there with a couple of friends. Well, there's about 6 or 7 of us, including his kids and da da da. And because I'm excited, I think I'm running races. Yeah. I don't even enjoy racing actually, but I'm at the races. It's a social occasion. There's lots of people there. It's a bit of a, you know, we're on a high, and so I would drink ridiculously quickly, but they don't. So I'm actually outpacing them.
Yeah.
And so I've gone to a place where they're not, but in the other direction. You know, it's not because they're not drinking and I am. It's because I'm drinking more than they are. But why am I doing that? Why am I getting so excited? Why do I do that? I think it's because I don't think I'm good enough without it.
Yeah, well, I think, that to me always comes full circle. And I suppose the reason I raised the issue of alcohol is quite often people who are in that zone of not feeling good enough or not dealing with feelings properly, they use alcohol to distract them.
Yeah, which is what you said earlier.
Yeah. So it's a negative coping.
Yeah, it is. It is. It's things, I can't do this unless I have a drink.
Yeah.
Like I said to you earlier about silences, I hate silences. Yeah. So I will fill it with shit.
Yeah.
Right. But then when you've had a drink, there aren't silences because you filled it with shit before you even know what you've said.
Yeah.
Wow. Sheila, honestly.
We've gone off a bit of a tangent.
Oh, with that, I don't know how long that was, but bloody hell, that was great. I really, really enjoyed that, actually.
Can I read one more quote?
Oh, yeah, of course you can. Yes.
I think.
Yes. We'll end on that, so I hope it's a good one.
Let's just see. I'll just check that I want to read it because.
Shall I just fill in? I don't know how to do that.
Fill in.
Can you edit this bit out?
So this chapter is really about, well, it's called Depressive Illness is a Political Issue. And it's all about how we manage mental health in the workplace. And it's a massive
topic. Do you know what?
And we've not even gone on
to
that.
We didn't even get to the point where we can change cultures.
No. So in my succinct way, I say awareness, education and changing culture are the three things you need to do in business.
Okay. All right. I'll just write that down.
This whole chapter is about you know, how organisations get it wrong. But I just thought this was quite poignant. So he says, protect your best workers. Don't assume they will always carry the load they have done. There is a strong temptation to focus your attention on the weakest points in your organisation, on the assumption that the strongest will look after themselves. No, they won't. They'll look after the company to their last breath, but they won't look after their own needs until forced to do so by illness. If you want to keep them operating, you'll have to watch over them, counselling against overwork if necessary. So what it's saying is your strongest workers are the ones that keep beavering away, and those are the ones you need to look after, and those are the ones that you don't look after.
That's so bloody true, that.
Because honestly,
when I was at Superdry, right, before I got fired, because of the story that people know and you know, I was loaded with extra responsibilities because, don't worry, Chaz will do it. But not thinking, actually, that's more than any one person can deal with.
Yeah.
And because I'm a macho twat, I said, I'll do it. I felt more important, you know, more responsibility. Yeah. Hey, you know, look at me. I'm the top dog here. You know, I can do this. Yeah. And actually, you can't. Mm. And then when I left, I did my catastrophizing.
Yeah.
Disappeared down a black hole that I've never been so deep before or since, I'm pleased to say.
Yeah.
And here we are now 10 years later, and I'm feeling not too bad.
And just one more point, because that's really interesting, because I do think that's also quite a male thing to keep going, because it's part of your ego and your status.
Yep.
And my husband does exactly that, but how it manifests in him is more physical illness than mental illness. Oh. So he actually gets to the point where his body, physical body rather than his mind, gives up, and so he will get some sort of viral infection or something. So it's interesting that everybody, it has to come out somehow, somewhere in your body or your mind, and the two are interlinked anyway.
They're the one and the same, aren't they? Yeah. But that's interesting about meditating and understanding where your body is at. Because that, if we could all get to grips with that, actually life would be a hell of a lot easier.
Absolutely.
And on that bombshell, as what's his name, Clarkson would say.
Yeah.
Sheila, honestly, thanks ever so much for coming
in.
Thank
you. I could talk for hours.
I know.
I've only scratched the surface.
Do you know what? I say that after everyone, but I genuinely think we could, and we may well do, because we're off to Krakow, aren't we?
We are, hopefully.
We've got to get the partners on board soon, particularly.
Yeah.
That'll be. I was going to say, if you want to get depressed. That's one of the Auschwitz obviously is there one of the places to go, but I think it's the opposite.
I think it'll be
awe-inspiring actually. And did we see something at the Literature Festival on finding awe? Claudia Hammond. It's a science festival.
I didn't. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely brilliant. So I don't count my blessings now. I count my awesome feelings.
That's a good one. Another good strategy.
That's what I do. Yeah, makes me feel better. Anyway, great stuff. Thank you.
Lovely. Thank you.
See you soon. Ta-ra.
Bye.
Bye.